I start with thank you, with thank yous, heartfelt thank yous to Heather and George for inviting us all together to think about this new way. This is a new way of doing public reading of Dante, and it's a way that I mean, it's very rare that we do things in a new way in Dante studies. I mean, I tend to say to my students that I'm very grateful to for my profession to none else than Giovanni Boccaccio, who was the first paid Dante professor ever. And so I mean, we go way back, and since Dante, since the way that Boccaccio read Dante, we haven't changed much. But the vertical readings are a challenging new way of reading Dante, Dante's poem, and see how that poem makes sense point by point, but also globally. So, thank you. Can you hear me? First of all, logistics. Fine, we're fine. I'm going to read, because I've tried to pack too much into this talk for me to just ramble, and so I'll read. I'll try to look at you while I'm reading, so if I see that you're lost, I won't stop. So you will have to stop me signaling something more. The talk has about four parts, and there's a long introduction. There is a summary of the cantos, and then an analysis of two themes, related themes in the cantos, and a little coda. So it's 4+1. We'll try to have as much text as we can on the board, but I assume your knowledge or fresh knowledge of the three cantos. Okay, here we go. Today we read together the 15th. But before we do that, let me try and sketch out the theoretical framework for my talk. These are a few points that I suggest we keep in mind while working our way through today's vertical reading. The idea of reading the poem in triads, looking for connections among cantos that bear the same number, appears to imply a very radical notion of design. To be sure, the enterprise is based on a set of pointed observations that have been in circulation for a while now. We have known for a long time, for instance, that there are strong elements connecting the three proemial cantos of the poem, or the three political cantos, those number six. Yet, the idea of extending the same detailed mapping of correspondences across the whole body of the Commedia seems to carry with it two related assumptions that we should not leave unscrutinized, so to speak. The first assumption that one may associate to a vertical reading is that we accept that the author's compositional control over his poem is not only absolute, but also preliminary. Which is to say that we accept that the layout of the poem, in which the narrative forward thrust is also balanced by a stringent system of proleptic signposts, was for Dante clear from the start. Now, and here comes, I mean, this is a revolutionary thing, TSL said that. Second assumption we should try and test. If we are ready to grant the author of the Commedia the ability to conceive such an ambitious plan, and Professor Corbett has made very good arguments about that, about the connection of 6 and 10 in Inferno, for instance, and 10 across the poem. So if you are ready to grant the author of the Commedia the ability to conceive such an ambitious plan, the elements we are able to muster as indications of a parallel planning of canto triads would be so subtle that only very few and very special kinds of readers could actually detect and activate them. If the book could be imagined as having sprung fully armed from the author's mind, what kind of reception was that author expecting? What kind of reader poring over or listening to the poem, with what kind of book in his or her hands was he constructing through such a project? These two theoretical and prejudicial questions are not simply abstract and preemptive. There are actually moments in Dante's text that militate against accepting these assumptions. For instance, even though we know fairly little, almost nothing, about the compositional history of the poem and its early dissemination, we do have indications that different plans may have been adopted in the course of its making. We can also see that some expectations created at a certain point in the text were never fulfilled. In the first category, so that of abandoned plans, we may think, for instance, of the structural and compositional corollaries of the so-called Diceria di Boccaccio. As you may know, in both his Life of Dante and his commentary to the Commedia, Boccaccio reports that, according to a local Florentine tradition, the poem had been composed in two distinct phases. The first 7 cantos in Florence, before the author's exile, and the rest, under a renewed spell of inspiration, prompted by the fortuitous finding of the first Florentine draft of the early cantos, later in his life, while in exile. Boccaccio pointed actually to a suture mark in the text, the famous resumptive clause at the beginning of Inferno 8, in continuing, I say, that well before we reached the high tower, our eyes went to the top of it. In that passage, Boccaccio flags the word seguitando as possibly the sign of a new compositional beginning. Now, while the chronological core of Boccaccio's Diceria has been with time rightly discredited, and we have no doubt that the poem is a work conceived and realized post-exile, as Boccaccio himself was inclined to think, we still have the impression that the suture points at the beginning of Inferno 8 do mark a discontinuity of sort. We have the impression, that is, that Dante had indeed started the poem not in a different time, but with a moral architectural plan for his hell based on the 7 deadly sins, and a narrative compositional plan in which one canto would correspond to each sin. The first 7 cantos do, as a matter of fact, conform rather well to that hypothesis, proceeding rapidly through lust, gluttony, and the paired scene of avarice and prodigality, and then the rapid dispatching of 2 more scenes, wrath and sloth, and the sloth at the end of canto 7 seems to suggest the exhaustion of that plan and the moment in which it yields to a new scheme. With the new landscape of the city of Dis first, and then with Virgil's lecture of Inferno 11, what appears to be a different plan for the moral geography of hell and the writing of Inferno is allowed to emerge and assert itself as the only, and hence we are made to assume the original plan for the poem. As an apparently similar change of plans, and here I start dealing with today's triad, we find, right in Inferno 15, an abandoned prolepsis. That is an anticipation with no fulfillment. When Brunetto Latini gives him one more prophecy of the imminent demise of the white Guelph party in Florence, now formulated as a personal prophecy of struggle, defeat, and exile, the protagonist states, "What you say about the course of my life, I am writing down, and I will have it glossed with another text by a woman who will know when I'll get to her." As we know, such a projected episode does not make it into the poem as planned and forecasted in Inferno. In Paradiso 15, in fact, Dante meets Cacciaguida, and it is his ancestor, not his guide, Cacciaguida, not Beatrice, who explains in Canto 17 the real meaning of Dante's exile, along with the ethical and poetic mission associated with it. The return of the technical term glosse, chiosar, gloss, now, explicitly marks the connection. Son, these are the glosses of what was said to you. These are the dangers that still lie hidden, but not for long, says Cacciaguida. This is an interesting ellipsis. Since in Purgatorio 15, talking about a different matter, that of free will and the appropriate use of material goods, Virgil creates a second and parallel proleptic reference to Beatrice's authority in doctrinal matters, and foreshadows an intervention on her part. You will see Beatrice, and she is the one who will quench this and any other desire for knowledge you may have. Oh, these are my poor translations, by the way. I'm trying to stay as close as possible to what Dante is saying there. Now, I will not go into the reasons for this change. Some proposals have been made, but all we could say would fall into the realm of speculation. It could be more interesting, rather, to point out that whatever the reason for the shift, whatever the meaning and the reason for the shift, the change in plans apparently took place after the writing of Purgatorio 15. There are other cases of prolepsis that are never fulfilled, promises that are never fulfilled. I'll go fast on this. This one regards Arrigo. Arrigo is a mysterious character who Dante is announced he is going to meet soon in Canto 6. when we go through the rest of Inferno, we can't find him. We find everybody else. We find Farinata, we find Mosca, we find Jacopo Rusticucci, Tegliaio, everybody but Enrico. So there's one too few characters that are being announced and never met. Opposite case, one too many. This is the only radical inconsistency in the how do you call it, in the prosopographical horizon of the poem. There is a character that is said to be in two different places at the same time. And this is Manto, the prophetess, whom is said to be among the limbo dwellers, and then we see her actually among the diviners. Two different places in the poem. Very fast. What do we do with this? What can we say about these inconsistencies in the poem? Are they the effect of a redirection of the narrative that took place in corso d'opera while the composition of the poem and its publication were ongoing? Apparently, the narrative body of the Commedia was not immune from twists and turns, changes of plans that have left moments in which the text falls upon itself or allows ellipses and eclipses. So we may ask, what kind of overall compositional plan could Dante have in mind? What kind of prolective signals could have been disseminated in the text if the poem was subject to these false starts, redirections, and contradictions? What about the readers then? Did Dante intend to get away with these inconsistencies, trusting the fact that his readers too, like Homer, may at times snooze? But then if a disengaged reader is what he expected, what are we to make of the subtle signals that we find connecting co-numerary cantos? These textual hiccups suggest that when we attempt a vertical reading, we should not base it on the assumption of total and preliminary authorial control and total readerly competence. Adopted as caveats, they help us respond to Dante's stratified text with a renewed critical awareness. They may help us to conceptualize, that is, an essential point about the poem, namely, that the writing and the reading of the Commedia are both processes unfolding in time. As such, the compositional and interpretive phenomena involved in the disposition of elements on the vertical axis exist in a linear proceeding of the poem's writing and reading and complicate it. And as such, any phenomena detected by a vertical gaze should also be studied in their timing, as a process producing sense rather than a set of data charged with meaning, forever residing in the semiotic reservoir of the text. Now, Dante's 15ths offer precisely the opportunity to test the hypothesis. So far, so good?
Yes.
Okay. At least in the case of one particular aspect in the text of Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradiso 15, the connection of two elements, father figures and imaginary fatherlands. To show these elements in action, I come to the body of my talk. Let me start by offering a summary of the three cantos. Inferno 15 is part of a diptych. Together with the next canto, it is dedicated to the third ring in the circle of violence. The circle is reserved for the punishment of violence against God, exerted indirectly. As Virgil explains in canto 11, this is the violence one does to things that emanate from the Creator, which is to say violence against nature and art. As we know, the next ring punishes the usurers who have sinned against God's grandchild, human art, in the way they have put money to work and dispensed with work themselves. The environment is here, in canto 15, the same as in the preceding canto, where we find the blasphemers, the violent against God directly, God himself. It is a barren, scorched plain, perpetually under a rain of fire, and it does not change for the next ring either. That's continuity. Groups of sinners run incessantly under these flakes of fire that burn their aerial bodies, their bodies made of air, and disfigure them almost beyond recognition. The central character in the canto is Brunetto Latini, a Florentine intellectual of the generation before Dante's. Traditionally presented as Dante's teacher, and Dante does acknowledge that he was taught by Brunetto come l'uom s'eterna, how man makes himself eternal. He is also cast as a father figure for the protagonist, who still cherishes his former cara immagine paterna, his beloved paternal image. We'll come back to this point. The episode in which Brunetto stars begins with the protagonist's surprise. Are you here, sir? Siete voi qui, ser Brunetto? An utterance in which Dante uses the honorific voi, reserved to a few characters throughout the poem. Only two more in Inferno, Farinata e Cavalcante, and one in Paradiso, Cacciavite. With Brunetto, the protagonist has a long conversation about civic Florentine politics and his own future, which includes a series of biblically styled prophetic utterances on Brunetto's part. In this most Florentine vernacular episode, Virgil is somewhat marginalized. His only speaking part consists in a single approving remark, "Bene ascolta chi la nota," that's it, underlying the righteousness of Dante's stance before the misfortunes that are awaiting him. The canto concludes with a list of other sinners, old Chierci, intellectuals, and members of the clergy, and with Brunetto's plea to be remembered for a literary work, his Tesor, which is to say the vernacular visionary poem we now call the Tesoretto, to distinguish it from his other and more massive work, the encyclopedic treatise in Old French entitled Le Trésor. As you can perhaps tell, I've been a bit reticent about what kind of sin is that of Brunetto and his ilk. While Virgil had made clear in Inferno 11 that violence against nature is associated with Sodom, there have been alternative hypotheses to identifying Brunetto's fault directly with homosexuality. One proposal has to do with Brunetto's choice of writing his magnum opus, De Tresor, in French. By doing so, it has been argued, Brunetto went against nature. He betrayed his natural native idiom for another that was foreign to him. The debate dates back to the 1950s, when André Pézard published his long essay Dante Under the Reign of Fire, insisting that Brunetto's sin has a linguistic rather than a sexual nature. The matter is difficult to adjudicate, but one element that our vertical gaze brings to the fore is that language, in particular vernacular language, does indeed play a part in Inferno 15, as we will see it does in Paradiso 15. But we are not there yet. We still have to work our way through the corresponding canto in Purgatorio. Purgatorio 15 is a rather different animal. Unlike Inferno 15, it is a canto of transition from the ledge of envy to the ledge of wrath, the last of the vices engendered by love directed to a wrong object. It is composed of four distinct movements. The first comprises the encounter with the angel of mercy. The angel performs for Dante the ritual transition out of the ledge of envy, cleansing one of the seven P's from the protagonist's forehead. The second movement is an andante riflessivo, encompassing a question from the protagonist about what exactly was meant by Marco Lombardo, the last soul with whom he talked in the previous canto, when he said, Marco Lombardo said, that we should not direct our desires, là ov'è mestier di consorzio il divieto, so in such things that cannot be held in common. And Dante's question is followed by Virgil's lengthy and passionate explanation of the difference between material and spiritual goods, the latter being subject to multiplication rather than division when shared. The third movement is the arrival on the ledge of wrath and the exposure of the protagonist to the new set of examples. Every ledge in Purgatorio has a set of examples associated to it. This time, they are examples of mercy, the virtue opposing the vice being purged on the new ledge. The examples are offered through a new means of delivery, ecstatic visions, and they start, as customary, with Mary. The episode encapsulated in the vision centers on the sweetness with which Mary, mother of Jesus, scolds her son, whom she and Joseph had lost in the throng of pilgrims gathered in Jerusalem for the celebration of Passover. We will soon come back to this episode as well. The other two examples are from Greek history and the early Christian history. The final section of the canto consists again of a lively exchange, a conversation in which Virgil explains to Dante what Dante knows all too well, namely that what he has been given are exemplary visions inciting to mercy. And Virgil tries to convince Dante that he knows a lot, perhaps too much, about what is going on in his pupil's mind. Paradiso 15. I'm going fast. Too fast? No, good. Paradiso 15 is based, as Inferno 15, on a single prominent character. So there's a balance there. The protagonist is here the soldier martyr Cacciaguida, Dante's Trisavolo, Dante's great-great-great-grandfather, I think, if I get the English ancestry right. Cacciaguida lived at the end of the 11th century. And the canto opens with the protagonist already situated in the heaven of Mars, where militant souls show themselves to him as lights forming a cross, on which mysteriously shines Christ. We have seen that the image at the beginning. One of these martial and militant souls now descends towards Dante. The text reminds the reader of a classical parallel. Not differently did Anchises come forward to welcome his son Aeneas in the Elysian fields, says Dante. In the same breath, however, it also adds a qualifying statement. Se fede merta nostra maggior musa, if we can trust our greatest source of inspiration, addressing Virgil's reliability in otherworldly matters. Perhaps in line with the classical paradigm just evoked, that of the Aeneid, the soul of Cacciaguida, adding sound to the jubilation of light and movement, pronounces a full tercet in Latin, O sanguis meus, and so on, O my son, O grace of God descending on you, when did ever the doors of heaven open twice for anyone? But Latin is not sufficient to discharge the affective tension, Dante says. The soul is so overjoyed that the meaning of his second outburst goes beyond human understanding. And we are left to wonder if this is a question of content or of idiom. Dante says that after having pronounced a tercet in Latin, Cacciaguida says something more that's so deep, so profound, he cannot understand. We are left to wonder, I say, if this is a question of content or of idiom. That is, did Cacciaguida still speak Latin, but about an incomprehensible reality? Or did he say something in the language souls use in heaven, whatever the language is? And whatever the answer to the linguistic question about the part of Cacciaguida's speech that the text does not include, we are told that the character eventually moves to a level of diction or a language geographically akin to that of his interlocutor. We know that is that once the heat of the affection has decreased, Cacciaguida moves to praise God in the vernacular, saying, Benedetto sia tu, trino e uno, che nel mio seme sei tanto cortese. Blessed are you, triune God, who has shown such grace to my progeny, to my seed. And in that language, he finally turns to address Dante, calling him figlio, my son. The protagonist answers by asking his name, and in the circumlocution describes the welcoming he has just received as a paterna festa, a fatherly welcome. In the dialogue that develops, Dante comes to know the identity of the soul as that of his ancestor, the root of the tree of which he is a branch. In the framework of an autobiography, Cacciaguida also gives Dante a summary of their family history, a portrait of the city of Florence in the past, and a brief account of his life and death as a crusader. The most extended section of his biographical presentation, which is taken up again in an even more extended form in the next canto, in Paradiso 16, contains the description of the city. Cacciaguida here sketches the portrait of a city imagined in an idealized, peaceful, modest, socially healthy setting, a past in which people mattered more than things, where certainty about one's role in society was a given, where origins reflected in the present. This was a city in which economic and social stability meant that generations could grow and age together in harmony, that no wife would be deserted, as Dante says, left alone in her bed because of her husband's business trips to France. Nulla era per Francia nel letto deserta. As I have tried to suggest in my summaries, some recurrent images emerged from the survey of the three cantos. Issues of language. Vernacular, Latin, translinguistic utterances are mixed and are brought into the mix. Plant imagery and the relation between seed, root, branches. Limitations imposed on the role and authority of the first guide, Virgil, and of his text, the Aeneid, when he's not present. But most prominently, questions surrounding seed life and concerns with models of paternity. The vertical reading of the poem allows us to see these recurrences better. It also helps us see that what recur are elements in a cluster of ideas connected to one another and not only each to its own repetition. So there is some horizontality together with the verticality of repetition. The ramifications uniting these recursive connections will concern us for the remaining time. We have a little bit of remaining time. Number one. Paternity. The first recursive connection is a macroscopic one. Both Inferno and Paradiso 15 talk about fathers. The connection is also literal. Brunetto is presented as a cara immagine paterna, and Cacciaguida's welcoming is defined as paterna festa. These are not, of course, the only fathers that Dante adopts in the comedy. Other salient figures addressed with this title are Virgil, Guido Guinizelli, Saint Peter, Adam, of course, Saint Bernard. But a lexical curiosity may be relevant here. The adjective paterna in the feminine appears only twice in the poem, in the passages you have on your slide. The next and only other occurrence is in the masculine, amor paterno, in Paradiso 17. But again, it is relevant because it refers to Cacciaguida. Now, the connection on this point is one that is not really difficult to interpret. Readers are asked to construct an oppositional pair from the two episodes and their protagonists. In one corner, we find Brunetto, the paternal man of letters, burned by the rain of fire in hell, earthly in the support he would have offered to Dante's mission, limited in the scope of his teaching, pointing to earthly fame as a viable surrogate of eternity. Opposite him stands Cacciaguida, the fatherly martyr, fully immersed in the glory of God, yearning for and yet peacefully awaiting in heaven for the encounter with his descendant, ready to give the protagonist a new perspective on work and fame, time and eternity, martyrdom and peace. These are all themes that Cacciaguida will rehearse for Dante. Very quickly, it may be interesting to know that the connections extend to the lexical level and cross the essential but not impervious borders of the canto. There is a second keyword that the poem redeploys for Cacciaguida, lifting it from the protagonist's encounter with Brunetto. The term is tesoro. In Inferno 15, Il mio tesoro indicates Brunetto's literary work in which he sees his only hope for a posthumous life. His last words to Dante in Inferno 15 are, in fact, Siete raccomandato il mio tesoro, nel quale io vivo ancora. The same phrase, il mio tesoro, and this is the only other time that it recurs in the poem as il mio tesoro, appears in Paradiso 17 for Cacciaguida. The transvaluation that it has undergone is, of course, radical. There is nothing earthly anymore in it, Cacciaguida having become Dante's treasure in heaven. But what about Purgatorio 15? Does it help in any way to connect these two cantos, or does Inferno need to leap over to Paradiso, and is Paradiso intended to fold back onto Inferno, skipping the in-between? Are there any fathers or treasures in Purgatorio 15? Well, I haven't found any treasures, but I have found fathers. There are quite a few fathers in the canto. First of all, there's Virgil, who is twice addressed as Padre Mio. More importantly, however, wedged between the two addresses to Virgil, we find a third instance of the word, which should actually count for two. In the passage quoted at the center, there is not just one father, but two of them. To be precise, there are two fathers for the distinction between which is actually the model for the distinction that the poem invites readers to draw between infernal and paradisal types of paternity. At the core of that episode, there is in fact an explicit contrast between the earthly and the heavenly paternity of Jesus. While Mary frames Jesus' paternity in terms of earthly cares, ecco dolenti lo tuo padre io ti cercavamo, which is a strict translation, as Dante always does with Mary's words, of the Latin of the Vulgate, Fili, quid fecisti nobis, son, why did you treat us this way? Look, your father and I, filled with anxiety, were looking for you. Jesus replies, alluding to a different plane on which his actions are to be understood. And he said to them, how is it that you sought me? Didn't you know that I must be in my father's house? These are words that Dante's text does not need to include. He only has Mary's words. Since they are embedded in the memory of the readers, their meaning is mysterious, says the Gospel of Luke. Mary and Joseph are explicitly said not to be able to understand what was meant by them. But it will soon become clear that they were already pointing to a different father whose work Jesus is soon going to begin doing, but not just yet. Thus far, the promise remains unfulfilled, the language obscure, a foreboding that has not become a foretelling. Patriotism. A discourse on fathers seems to attract also talk of fatherhood. Padri e patrie, fathers and fatherlands, have more than just an etymological connection in Dante. The second macroscopic intersection between Inferno and Paradiso 15 is that both cantos tell a tale of two cities. Actually, once we read them vertically, And yes, and there's an ironic projection, you know, onto the tale of two cities of Dante. We can see that the cantos number 15 tell a tale of several pairs of cities. The first level of urban analysis and the ideal dichotomy may be found in the tale of degeneration that is told in the poem by way of a hermeneutic suggestion. The text invites readers to move backward in time. Well, backward, not in time, backward in the reading, from the Florence of the good old days that we find in Paradiso 15 and 16 to the corrupted Florence of the present, which is depicted in Inferno 15 and 16. Florence, let's look at that. Let's look at the bad side of the coin. Florence, Renato explains to the protagonist, is currently under the rule of the same vices diagnosed in Inferno 6 by Charco: pride, envy, and avarice, the vices of civic dissension and societal dissection. The three mortal sins that are identified by Charco and Brunetto are perhaps to be seen in a precise constellation. I mean, this recurrence between 6 and 15 should make us think that the two triads come back, you know, unmodified. In formulating a diagnosis for Florence's political sickness, Dante is apparently adopting the common medieval perspective of the sermones ad status, the sermons preached to a specific audience which associated a particular sin to a particular stratum in society. In the parallel speeches of Canto 6 and 15, pride may be taken as the sin typifying the black wealths, who preach an aristocratic and warlike ethos and often practice it. They are the violent ones. On the other hand, greed and the aristocrats. Greed may be taken as the sin typifying the white guelphs, who are merchants at heart and in practice, more inclined to peace and negotiations than to military action. Envy, then, would be the sin opposing each party to the other. The white guelphs envy the black guelphs' status, which they see as based on pride, as it actually is. The black guelphs envy the white guelphs' affluence, which they see as based on greed, as it actually is. Charco and Brunetto diagnosis focus on the political situation leading up to and including the year 1302, the disastrous year when Charles of Valois entered the city of Florence as peacekeeper on a papal mandate, and the Pope was Boniface VIII, and basically left free rein to the black Guelphs in their bloody campaign of proscriptions against their adversaries, one of whom was Dante. But that is 1302. What about the Florence of the early 1100s? When Cacciavite was around. The contrast between the city of the present and that of the past is essentially ethical and pointedly retrospective. In the way Cacciavite describes the Florence he was born into and that he knew growing up, we find exactly the virtues opposing the vices for which we have heard the city being indicted by Brunetto. In the triad of adjectives that he uses to describe his quasi-heavenly Florence, we can see a point-by-point response to the social vices Brunetto and Charco had isolated. Fiorenza dentro della cerchia antica si stava in pace, sobria e pudica. Florence, still contained within the first round of walls, lived in peace, restrained and modest, says Cacciaguida. In the time span of the few generations, envy will eventually break peace. Avarice will overcome restraint, and pride will shatter modesty. Dante's interest in the past is, let us be clear, neither nostalgic nor is it archaeological in any way. The city of the past is evoked only in order to talk about the present. The Florence of Cacciaguida exists in order not only to elicit a reaction from the reader, but also to trigger an authentic ideological reaction in the text, precipitating a counter-model to the city of the present. The scheme of associations, once again, is easy to detect in the external connumeraries. We have the bad version of a father telling about the bad side of the common fatherland in hell, and that is in Inferno 15. Then we have the good version of a father reminiscing about the good version of the common fatherland in Paradise, and that is Paradiso 15. Both cantos, incidentally, also have a coda in the next units. In Inferno 16, is being devoted to the noble, harmonious homosexuals that inquire about the current state of the city and lament its demise. And Paradiso 16 is being similarly devoted to an even more detailed account of the harmony that characterized the life of the nobility in the city of Caccialuccia's times. The two Florence, however, are not the only cities for which Dante tells a double story. In both Brunetto and Caccialuccia's speeches, there is a constant reference to Rome as the positive model to which the lost city of Florence needs to conform itself. Both Brunetto and Caccialuccia insist on the necessary biological connection of Florence to Rome, and both evoke the fall of Fiesole as the myth of origin for the city. The mixing of the Roman Florentine stock with the Fiesolani is a moment of downfall which is revisited and repeated by modern Florentines, according to Caccialuccia, who have allowed their city to grow too much, inviting in the people from the neighboring towns and the countryside. The Florence of the past and that of the present are both measured by the ideal of Rome. And Brunetto and Caccialuccia make the point rather forcefully. Brunetto twice accuses Florence of having been contaminated ab origine by the mixing of races with the people from Fiesole, the city who was guilty of having supported Catiline in his attempt to overthrow the Roman Republic, as Cicero tells the story. This is the meaning of the passages on the slide. When Brunetto says, "The ungrateful people descended from Fiesole will become your enemy for your good deeds," and then again, in even clearer terms, "Let these beasts from Fiesole make forage of themselves and not touch the plant in which lives the holy seed of the Romans, who remained in the city when Florence was built, that nest of so much evil." L'ottimo commento explains the legend behind the Roman foundation myth of Florence, when he says, "Note that after the battle against Catiline at Campo Piceno, the Roman put Fiesole under siege. Since the siege was a long one," I love this idea, they had to spend so much time there, "some Romans set up their habitations in the valley. Once the Fiesolani surrendered, they were forced down the hill. The city of Florence was populated with them and the Roman veterans who decided to stay." To a summarized version of this myth, Caccialuccia comes back, as you can see, to lend his authoritative support. In describing the Florence of his time, he recounts how women, while spinning wool, would tell their families the legends of the Trojans, of Fiesole, and of Rome. Now, it may well be that the text asks us to consider scant the credibility of the city's mythical origins in the fabulous and fable-like versions that are attributed to the women of ancient Florence. However, they are fabulae, so they are fable-like. They don't have historical truth at their core. However, the power of Rome to provide a city with an ideal, but not impractical model for the formation of their citizens is reasserted in the following lines. In Caccialuccia's good old days, people who have marveled at vicious characters like Lapo Saltarello or Ciangella, a barrister and an adulteress, respectively, as they would now marvel at seeing Cincinnatus or Cornelia, models, respectively, as you know, of civic rectitude and modesty from the Roman Republican past. In sum, the axis Florence-Rome is apparently the main historical trajectory that Dante adopts for this point. The Rome that was and the Florence that might have been are what keeps the civic idealism of the point going. And the passages in which the positive juxtaposition of the two cities is offered speak clearly in stark moralistic terms. At the core of Dante's idealizing and denouncing of his fatherland at the same time, however, lies an often undetected problem. The ideal Florence-Rome connection established in Inferno and Paradiso 15 by the two paternal figures is so central to the historical and political ideology of the poem that it has naturalized itself. But that association did not come as naturally or as free from troubles to medieval minds as it came to Dante. Rome is not, that is, an unqualifiedly good model for the city. There is a third set of two cities that I think is mobilized in the cantos number 15, a new and perhaps even more radically opposed diet, and it is perhaps only thanks to the intervening connumerary, Purgatorio 15, that we are able to see. If Florence of the present is opposed to the Florence of the past in Inferno and Paradiso 15, and both cities ideally project a polarized connection to Rome in the poem, then in Christian culture, Rome is opposed to Jerusalem. And Rome is not the positive pole in this opposition. In constructing the opposing models of an earthly and a heavenly city in his De Civitate Dei, Augustine forever pitted against one another the two cities, the old pagan Rome, all too earthly and destined to disappear in the new age of the sun, against the new Jerusalem prophesied by Ezekiel and existing as the militant church in the here and now of the new Christian dispensation. These two cities Augustine called the city of man and the city of God, as you will know. Let us go back to the episode of the young Jesus in the temple in a more extended version. The city of Jerusalem is assumed as the central trope of the story, and the trope is one suggesting both the holiness of the city in itself and the centrality it assumes in God's plan. In the economical narrative, very fast narrative of the Gospel of Luke, the connection of city and temple acts as catalyst for the story. Living under the law, Joseph and Mary participate in ritual converging of the Jews in Jerusalem for Passover, the pilgrimage that has at its core the worship at the temple. The temple is important. At the end of the festival, Joseph and Mary leave the city, but Jesus stays behind. When they realize he's not in the caravan, they go back to the city and look for him there. On the third day, they finally find him in the temple. The temple is, as the young Jesus obscurely says, the house of his Father, the place on earth where God's presence is most concrete. Now, staying on the gospel. At once, marking continuity and the break in it, Jesus starts revealing himself right in the center of the religious capital of Judaism. Now, with the example of Jesus in the temple, the Purgatorio episode allows the model of this holy city to emerge in Dante's text. The problem is that this model, as I said, is not the one that the text of Inferno and Paradiso themselves so brazenly have adopted and have proposed in the Connumerari Cantos. So can we find a way, anyway, to write it off the poem? Should we find a way to bypass Jerusalem and the context of Purgatorio 15 in order to keep Dante's Romanness alive and imperial fealty alive? I don't think we can, nor should we, because there is one final element. Yes, that's the right slide. There is one final element that recommends a meditation on the first example of meekness offered in Purgatorio 15, as proposing that readers consider a counter-model not only to Florence, but also to Rome, to the Rome that Inferno and Paradiso 15 have evoked. It is an element that supports the relevance of the episode for our vertical reading of the 15th. Now, while archaeological evidence about the temple in Jerusalem was out of Dante's reach and that of many of his contemporaries, there is a textual tradition that associates a specific number to the temple, and in particular to the ascent to the temple in ritual pilgrimage. This number, as you may see, is 15. In medieval numerology, 15 is only seldom commented upon. It's not one of the big, you know, heavy hitters. It's not 7, 3, 9, 10. But when it is, the first and foremost connection that is established is with Jerusalem and the temple at its center. In a short treatise, for instance, attributed to Isidore of Seville on numbers in the Bible, we read the following two interpretations of today's number. Rightly thus, this number signifies the unity of the Testaments. This is the reason why Paul the Apostle spent 15 days in Jerusalem with Peter, as it is said, so that he could collate with him both Testaments. But this number 15 is also ascribed mystically to the temple of the Lord. 15 were the steps around the temple on which stood the priests and the Levites, according to the order of their merits. Modeled on those steps, the prophet also sang 15 songs of the steps through which, gradually rising, one may complete the ascent to the temple of the celestial Jerusalem. In the twofold interpretation that Isidore proposes for the number 15, we find the same elements that make the episode taking place in the temple of Jerusalem so central for a canto bearing the number. The mystical number for the temple is 15. 15 are the steps leading up to it. 15 are the so-called gradual psalms, Psalms 119 through 133, which were traditionally sung during the ascent to the temple, or getting there. And the temple of the earthly Jerusalem may be read tropologically as the sign of the celestial Jerusalem, to which we ascend via a moral progression. Now, this connection, like all numerological connections, no matter how tempting, should not be overburdened with interpretation. The number 15 is not, I repeat, it's not the solution to the question of the many contrasted pairs of cities that Dante presents as his fatherlands. Yet, the emerging of Jerusalem as a third positive model city should at least give us pause. What role, if any, should we assign to this allusion to the city that Augustine had chosen as the positive counterpart of Rome in this canto, which is vertically coordinated to two other Roman-centered cantos? Is it Dante's guilty cultural subconscious that forces him to keep Jerusalem ever so slightly and obliquely in the political picture, even when he is adhering to a fully imperial and philo-Roman platform in his ideological and ideal urban planning? Or are we presented with a moment of radical in itinerary revision, the revising of a position held during the composition of Inferno, which felt difficult, if not untenable, while working through the connumerary canto in Purgatorio? But then, what should we do with the almost perfect alignment of Inferno and Paradiso 15 on the Roman model? Did Dante change his mind again? Was the revision revised in his third when he reached the triumphantly imperial sections of Paradiso, where Rome is the bearer of God's sign, Paradiso 6, and all its conquests are God-willed, part of a providential plan leading to the incarnation and passion of the Christ? If Roman history is sacred history, is Rome Dante's sacred city, as we learn from Paradiso 6 and Dante's De Monarchia? But then again, what are we to make of Jerusalem? What are we to make of the fact that in Paradiso 15, the soul who speaks to Dante about lineage and paternity, Florence and Rome, and about one's mission in life, did actually die during the Second Crusade, when Jerusalem was the capital of the Christian kingdom? Let me go back now, in concluding, to the framing questions I articulated at the start of my talk. One of the goals of this talk was to provide suggestions evaluating three interdependent hypotheses about the conception and interpretation of vertically connected elements in the poem. The first hypothesis may be formulated as follows. Is it possible to locate the building blocks of Dante's internal art of allusion already in the first cantica, already in Inferno? Are the proleptic signals so overdetermined as to create an expectation, a hermeneutic void that will be filled later by later developments of the poem? In our case, does Brunetto lay down the groundwork for Purgatorio 15 and for Cacciaguida? Are they, if not predictable, at least partially retrodictable? Or rather, and this is the second hypothesis, should we see the connections at work only retrospectively, reaching back from the second to the first half of what philologists think must have been the first authorial edition of the poem? We think that Dante had published Inferno e Purgatorio together, never Paradiso as a full edition. He died before he could do that. Is it Purgatorio that makes Inferno its counterpart, canto by canto, in the first two cantica edition of the poem in 1313 or 1316? We have no idea, really. Is, in other words, the first example of meekness with Jesus' evocation of the Heavenly Father in contrast with the earthly one that validates the paternal theme in Inferno 15 and retrospectively signposts it, creating and immediately occupying a slot in the corresponding canto in Paradiso? Does it book a slot in Paradiso? Or rather, and this is the final hypothesis, is it only with the final installment in place, with the writing and reading of Paradiso, that the verticality of some of these connections passes from virtuality to reality, from potential to act? Is it only with the third, final element, that the triad becomes interpretable as such? Is it in some only Cacciaguida that makes Brunetto his antecedent, not only as inadequate father figure, but also as provisional participant in the common condemnation of the decline of Dante's fatherland? And does this vertical connection happen only thanks to the fortuitous presence of a father question and a city question in Purgatorio 15? And does this happen in spite of the fact that in terms of city models, the middle canto is pointing in a very different direction? I, for one, don't know. What about you? Thank you.